Testing my microphone. I think I'm on. Has anybody not read the Chronicles of Narnia? Not read. Okay, there's a few. The Chronicles of Narnia, all about Narnia and what's most important there, Aslan the Lion, and how people... It's okay. Karina, it's okay. It's a great story, as we know. The doings of the great king, Aslan, and how people relate to him and do his will. The Chronicles in the Bible are less read than the Chronicles of Narnia, I fear, but they're important also. We're going to look today at a few chapters and a few incidents from the Chronicles, First Chronicles. There's a phrase in First Chronicles, the Chronicles of King David. That's a good summary of the first book of the two-book series. Chronicles probably was written around 400 B.C. by a priest after the Jews started to come back from captivity in Babylon. And they used books that we have in the Bible, Samuel, Kings, and other books that we don't have, to put together a history going back to Adam. The first verse of First Chronicles is this: Adam, Seth, Enosh. And its genealogy is tracing God's hand right from Adam all the way to the return from Babylonian exile. The main point of First Chronicles is King David and how God raised him up and how he established proper worship in the temple. The second book of Chronicles is about King Solomon and all the kings that followed him, the destruction of Jerusalem, and then the return, the beginning of the return from Babylon of the captives. So it really is quite an expansive story. The main points of the two books of Chronicles are true kingship centered in David and true worship centered in the Ark or the Tabernacle and then later Solomon's Temple. We're just talking about First Chronicles today, and we'll look at both of those issues, the king and the Ark, the proper place of worship. Recently, I was reading about King David and reading the Chronicles and how his predecessor, King Saul, turned out to be an unfaithful king. He died a terrible death, humiliating death, on the battlefield. And there's just many dramatic stories about David and how he came to power and how he dealt with people. And it just struck me that there's some principles here for how we live at New Covenant going forward in this new year that would be worth looking at these stories of David and then seeing how they might apply to us. So that's the plan today. There's a key verse in Romans 15:4. Everything that was written in the Scriptures was written for our instruction, that by the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. So it is, in a way, dry, dusty history, but it is given for our instruction. And I trust God will instruct us today as we look at this together. So, five dramatic stories. And I'm going to start in 1 Chronicles 12. Chapter 10 tells us, a little background here first. I mentioned the Ark of the Covenant. This was a box about 4 feet long, about 3 feet deep, and about 3 feet high. Not so very different from this table right in front here. And it was, God gave specific instructions how to make it in Exodus 25. It was to be covered with gold plating. Inside of it, a copy of the Ten Commandments would sit. And there were two angels, one on each side, with their wings over spreading it. And the top of it was the mercy seat. And that's where the priest put blood of the sacrifice once a year as an atonement for the sins of the people. So this box that was carried around by the Levites, there was rings in the box and they had poles and they carried it from place to place. It survived that 40 years in the desert. Then under Joshua, and he made a tent for it at Shiloh, a city not so far north of Jerusalem now. And it survived apparently during the judges period and up till the time of Samuel, the last judge. And there it sat in Shiloh in a tent, the tent of meeting. And that was the focused place where God's presence was known. Now, living among the Israelites were the Philistines. And they were on the Mediterranean Sea more, but they came over into Israel's territory, and they often would raid them and capture them and harass them. And Israel wanted to have a king like every other nation. And so Samuel didn't advise that, but people wanted it, and God said, go ahead. And so God picked out Saul, King Saul, to be the king. And he started off okay, but he disobeyed God two times, actually. Once in offering sacrifices when he felt they needed to be offered, and only the priest should do that, or only Samuel should do that. Another time, God had said to Saul, kill all the Amalekites. And he didn't. And so Samuel said to Saul, you have rejected the word of the Lord. The Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. And it wasn't so long after that that he was in battle and the Philistines overran his position. Saul was wounded by archers, arrows, and instead of being captured, he fell on his sword and committed suicide. I forgot one detail. The Israelites were doing poorly with the Philistines, so they said, I bet if we brought the ark out of Shiloh, out of the tent there, and brought it to the battlefield, God would certainly protect us. Basically, a magic box. So they brought the box out of Shiloh to the battlefield. The Philistines saw that, and this is remarkable. They said, oh, we're in trouble because this is the God who destroyed Egypt. That was several hundred years before. And the Chronicles records, they said, the Philistines said, be strong. Don't let this frighten you. And so they fought and they killed Saul. They killed Jonathan. They killed off the royal family, basically. And they took the ark home. Well, they set it up next in the temple of their god, Dagon. The next morning, they came in, and there was the idol to their god flat on his face. They thought, well, that was strange. They set it up. They came back the next morning, and this time, the head had been cut off. The hands had been cut off of this idol. And they said, we can't let this box stay here anymore. So they moved to the next town. And the next town, the Bible, ESV has the word tumors. Tumors broke out among the people. And some commentators think it was the bubonic plague, a rat carried by rat fleas. So that wherever it went, there was a plague. So for over 7 months, the cart went around the Philistines area, and they didn't know what to do with it. Finally, somebody had an idea. Okay, we're gonna find two milking cows. We're gonna hitch them up like oxen on a cart and put this box on the cart and see what happens. They did that, and as soon as the box was, the ark was on the cart, the two cows, now cows don't go like oxen, I'm told. Oxen might work together, but two cows that have calves, they don't do that. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but the cows, as soon as they got released, they went straight toward Israel, the boundary with Israel. And I think the Philistines knew they were touching something, involved with something that was way beyond them. So that's the background of the card. So that it came back to Israel, to a place, Beth Shemesh, and then it went to another place, Kiriath Jearim, and it stayed there for many years. In a way, it seems it might have been forgotten, but it stayed there for many years. And during this time was when the Lord directed Samuel to David. And you remember the story, perhaps. The Lord said to Samuel, go to Jesse's home, and I'll tell you who to anoint. So all of Jesse's sons came out, and it wasn't the right one. And finally, Samuel said, any other sons in this family? And Jesse said, I have a young boy out watching the sheep. Bring him in, Samuel said. And it was David, and it was the one God wanted. So Samuel anointed him. He wasn't installed as king, but he was anointed as king. Saul became jealous, tried to kill David. David ran away, didn't fight back. And finally we come to the end of Saul, where he was defeated at Mount Gilboa, and he committed suicide, and the ark was lost. So that's a little background on the ark, and the background about David. He was chosen by God, and he was, as a young man, trusted God, and he found God's help as he took care of the sheep. He even killed a lion and a bear with God's help, and he killed Goliath, as we all know. So now we get to chapter 12 of 1 Chronicles. So chapter 12 starts off that David was not free to move around freely because of Saul, son of Kish. So editorially, there's something's not quite in order here, but we're going to read this. We'll take it as it stands. That Saul is still operating, but in chapter 12, Israelites from all over come to David, and they pledge their support. And it must have been common knowledge that here this young man, David, was anointed king by Samuel. And they came. And it starts in verse 2, 1 Chronicles 12. Some Benjaminites came. They were archers, and they were bowmen, and they could shoot arrows and sling stones with either the right hand or the left hand. Isn't that interesting? Do you know anybody who could throw stones with either hand? Just let's have a sidebar here. I was curious. Has there ever been switch pitchers in baseball? And there has been. I didn't know that. I looked it up. There was one pitcher in the 1800s. But most recently, and even currently, there was a switch pitcher. Do you know that? Pat Venditti, who's got a contract with the Giants for 2019. And if you just pardon a little digression here. Pat Venditti was raised by his father. He's naturally right-handed, but he was raised to use both hands throwing. And he learned how to punt with both feet. I should say with either feet, either foot. And he was called up. He was on the Oakland A's organization. He was called up on June 5th, 2015, and they were playing the Red Sox. Does anybody remember this? Remember Pat Venditti? You remember it? I did not remember. This was new to me. I looked at the YouTube video. So he gets in there. He's a relief pitcher in the eighth inning. The A's are losing 4-2. He faces Brock Holt. He pitches left-handed. He gets him out. Next batter, Hanley Ramirez, right-hander. He switches he's got a special glove with six fingers, puts it on his left hand. Now he pitches to Hanley Ramirez. He gets a hit. The next guy's right-handed. He gets a double play. He's out. Ninth inning, he pitches three up and three down. And it was the most amazing thing to see that. I think there was a third switch pitcher in Major League history, but only three. So here is a bunch of Benjaminites who could use the bow, both hands, who could throw with both hands. Amazing. The whole chapter, chapter 12 now, we're back to serious business here, is one tribe after the other coming forward and saying, David, we're on your side. Next was the Gadites, verse 8. Mighty and experienced warriors, expert with shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, and who were swift as gazelles upon the mountains. The least of these men were a match for 100, and the greatest for 1,000. Let's grant a little hyperbole here. We don't see one man defeating 1,000 very often. But there they were. Verse 20, they come from Manasseh, mighty men of valor. Verse 22, from that day, from day to day, men came to David to help him until there was a great army, like an army of God. And then it lists tribe by tribe, starting at verse 24, Judah, Simeon, Levi, they all come. And it's interesting, look at verse 40. Also their relatives, from as far as Issachar and Zebulun and Naphtali, that's way up north by the Sea of Galilee. They came bringing food on donkeys and on camels and on mules and oxen, abundant provisions of flour, cakes of figs, clusters of raisins and wine and oil, oxen and sheep. For there was joy in Israel. Why was there joy in Israel? What moved these people, all these people, fighters and non-fighters, to come? I think it was very simple. They knew David was their hope. Saul's family, no hope there, but they knew David was the hope, was their hope. And he was. So there is the first dramatic event. David kind of dodging Saul, but to David come representatives from all the tribes and people ready to supply all they needed for food. Okay, second dramatic event, chapter 13. It's the first four verses. David had a thought to get the ark moved from where it was to Jerusalem. And look what it says. David consulted with the commanders of thousands and of hundreds, with every leader. And David said to all the assembly of Israel, if it seems good to you and from the Lord our God, let us send abroad to our brothers who remain in all the lands of Israel, as well as to the priests and Levites in the cities that have pasture lands, that they may be gathered to us. Then let us bring again the ark of our God to us, for we did not seek it in the days of Saul. All the assembly agreed to do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. I just think it's remarkable how carefully David consulted with the whole group, the military people, all the assembly, and they all agreed, yes, let's do that. And I think this is a remarkable example of engaging the people in an important decision. Okay, third dramatic event, chapter 13, starting at verse 6, verse 5. He starts to move the ark. People are excited. Look at verse 6 and 8. David and all Israel were celebrating before God with all their might, with song and lyres and harps and tambourines and cymbals and trumpets. Suddenly, the ark is being moved on a cart pulled by oxen. And Uzzah and Ahio are with the ark. The oxen stumble. The ark starts to fall off the cart. Uzzah tries to put it back on, and immediately the Lord strikes him dead. How's that for a dramatic event? What would you do if you were Uzzah? I think I would do the same thing. Here is this box which has such a history with the Philistines, not to mention with the Israelites, wouldn't you do the same thing? The Lord strikes him dead. He died there. Look at verse 10. He died there before God. And David was angry because the Lord had broken out against Uzzah. And that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day, which that means the breaking out against Uzzah. All we can say is God's holiness and his requirements of worship, he evidently takes them much more seriously than these people did and that we do, I have to say. As we'll find out in chapter 15, David remembered or was told or somehow knew the right way to move this ark was the Levites carry it. You don't put it on a cart. They put poles through the rings and they carry it on their shoulders. Levites do it, not just anybody. And somehow that didn't come up with all this consultation. I'm surprised at that, but it didn't. So that's the third event, that God strikes down Uzzah. Okay, there's another event, chapter 14, starting at verse 8. The Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over all Israel. All the Philistines went up to search for David, but David heard of it and went out against them. Now the Philistines are going to make a raid at verse 10. David, 14:10, David inquired of God, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" The Lord said to him, "Go up, I will give them into your hand." So David advanced, he struck them down, and he was successful. Not long after that, the Philistines had another raid. This is verse 13. And again, David wisely prayed, "Should I go up against them?" God said, "You shall not go up against them." No, you can't, don't. And then God explained his thought. "Go around them, go opposite the balsam trees. When you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then go to battle, for God has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines." So God was doing something to frighten them or to throw them off course or do something, but God had something to do. So he said to David, "No, don't go right now." So David obeyed. He did as God commanded him, and they struck the Philistine army from Gibeon to Gezer. And the fame of David went out into all lands, and the Lord brought the fear of him upon all nations. So that's quite a change, I think. David is afraid of the Lord the way he treated Uzzah. But that didn't stop David from pursuing God in prayer when he needed to. And he did, and he listened, and he did exactly what God said. And the fame of David went out into all lands, and the Lord brought the fear of him upon all the nations. So now the fear is in the other foot, at the other side. They're afraid of David. One more dramatic event, the fifth one, in chapter 15. Now, after 3 months where the ark had been, David says, "Let's bring this up to Jerusalem." And look at verse 2. David said that no one but the Levites may carry the ark of God, for the Lord had chosen them to carry the ark of the Lord and to minister to him forever. And look at verse 13. Because you did not carry it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us, because we did not seek him according to the rule. So the priests and the Levites consecrated themselves to bring up the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, and the Levites carried the ark of God on their shoulders with the poles, as Moses had commanded according to the word of the Lord. The rest of the chapter reveals some of David's planning for worship. And the following chapters go into much more detail. Who should be the singers? Who should play the cymbals? Who should play the lyre, the stringed instruments? And he picks ones that have skill in these areas. And he organizes it, and he puts people in charge. And it's very thoughtfully done. Look at verse 22. Chenaniah, leader of the Levites in music, should direct the music, for he understood it. And David was very intentional about getting people who were skilled in place. So the result, look at the verse 27. David was clothed with the fine linen, and the singers, and Chenaniah, the leader of the music of the singers, and David wore a linen ephod. So all Israel brought up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord with shouting to the sound of the horn, trumpets, and cymbals, and made loud music on harps and lyres. So it's a big positive community experience to get this ark moved a few miles from Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem. And all the people are involved, and they're doing it right this time. I wonder, where was anybody who knew the rules? In chapter 13, David consulted with everybody. Either David simply forgot, or somebody who knew didn't speak up, which might have avoided the loss of this man Uzzah. But this time they got it right, and it's a time of great celebration and community worship and joy. Well, I mentioned this verse in Romans when I started, that whatever was written is written for our instruction, that through the endurance and encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope. And I just want to briefly say what to me seems like instruction that comes out of stories like these. There's probably many applications, but I just think of five, which I've listed in the bulletin here. First principle, take joy in the King. Well, we don't serve King David, we serve King Jesus. And how positively the people thought about David, which explains why they devoted themselves so freely to him, how much more positive do we have a right to think of Jesus, our King? Do we really believe Jesus is in charge, able to handle whatever enemies or problems God allows to come into our lives? Do we believe this? The chapter 12 ends, there was joy in Israel. So I was sharing my notes with Anne, and she said, Craig, how much joy do you have? And she wasn't trying to be snide, she was just saying that's a fair question. Do I deeply rest in the fact that Jesus is adequate for every test that we as a family, or we as a church family have? We have reason to know that he is adequate. I think we all have, we all can grow in, I'm thinking of James chapter 1, in expressing joy when our perseverance is challenged. Or 2 Corinthians 12, can we boast in our weakness, because when we're weak, then we're strong, as Paul said. Or Philippians 4, make your requests known to God with thanksgiving, and the peace of God will guard your hearts and minds. Or even Hebrews 4 mentions coming to the throne of grace because of Jesus, our high priest, who is sympathetic. He understands our weakness. So the one principle is take joy in our King, just the way the Israelites took joy in David and what they knew he was going to do for them. Second principle, every person service to the King. It's just striking how carefully the chronicler wrote all the tribes, how many hundreds or thousands of people volunteered. And he included many that weren't military. So that's a call to us, I think, to as a body, that every one of us offers service to Jesus, our King. And I mentioned earlier, my thanks ends in my thanks for meals that have been shared, and I'm not the only one to get meals in time of need. And I feel we have this spirit here among us of every member's service to the body. And that's a blessing. But the needs of each other will never stop. There'll always be needs of encouragement, if not specific financial or other needs. So let's just remember this scene in 1 Chronicles 12. Everybody was ready to do what they could to help David. Third principle, every person engagement with the king, chapter 13. And here we think immediately of a new covenant, a New Testament principle that every member of the body, it has a manifestation of the Spirit for the common good, 1 Corinthians 12. One of our jobs as leaders is to hear how the Lord is leading each of you, each of us, and what insights you have. But the Lord himself cares about your contributions and your concerns and your insights. I've often said, in the body, each of our faculties can sense certain dangers. We can see things coming, we can smell a fire if a smoke is coming, or we can hear noises. But we're not all ears, eyes, and nose. We all have separate gifts and separate concerns and separate, what do I want to say here, receptors for sensing danger or need in the body. And it's important that you share those as you have them with each other, with us leaders. Here's another, the fourth principle. Fear, pray to, and obey God. Am I afraid of God when something shocking comes up? I mentioned Anne's knee and her ankle. It's just very uncomfortable and it's not clear what to do about it. Well, do I just kind of back away in fear and discouragement, or do I pursue prayer and the Lord more fervently because of it? I like the way David didn't run from God when he was afraid of him. He pursued him when he needed to in prayer, and he heard the answer from God, and he obeyed. The Lord's ways are not our ways. And he does things that we would never think of doing. But can we pursue him anyway? In the knowledge that he really is the king and he really has our long-term interest at heart. The last principle, every person proper worship of God, which chapter 15 illustrates the Israelites did on that day. What's proper worship? Well, just real briefly, the Bible mentions the Father is seeking people to worship him in spirit and in truth. The Holy Spirit is, and his leading is part of true worship. And it's truthful. It's candid about needs, candid about God's greatness. Proper worship is Jesus-centered. Colossians chapter 1. God intends that Jesus becomes supreme in everything. So we don't just have singing about any old thing. We have singing that ultimately traces back to Jesus and how adequate he is. We have time to share a bit in public meetings, as we did today, of the work of God in our lives. It's much easier in smaller groups like shepherding groups or informal conversations. But that's the proper worship, where we each of us shares the work of God as we see it in our hearts. So I stop here with this little summary that Jesus is our King. How blessed we are. How much we can relax, even with the pressures and uncertainties that we face. And is this something that leaves us with a sense of joy. Anne asked me that question, do I have a sense of joy? And we both thought of a couple people over the years that we've met that exude joy. I'd like to be more like them. I know personalities are different, but joy is deep contentment at the goodness of God. Secondly, Jesus is very interested that each of us serve him wholeheartedly and serve each other in the body. Third, Jesus invites our fellowship. He said, if you open the door, I'll come in. I'll eat with you and you with me. He longs to engage with us, to talk over and to mull over and to process what's happening in my life and in my family, my church, what's happening. And how is Jesus part of it? And the fourth point, Jesus knows that following him is costly. He said, you have to deny yourself. Every day take up a cross in order to follow you, to be your disciple, to be Jesus' disciples. How do I react to God after sometimes shocking providence or things happen that I don't understand or don't like? Do I come to prayer in Jesus? Do I pray right away? Do I listen, expecting an answer? David got an answer. Should I do it? Yes. Should I do it? No. Sometimes we need specific answers, and I think we should pray with that expectation. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. How good to express praise and worship together. I should say thank you to Jeff. Thank you to Doug for leading us in worship. May we grow in that. So there's many, many points that relate to the signs that we have in the entryway coming in. The first job, to connect with God. And here we see this happening in this chapter, in these chapters. To grow, and to serve each other, and to go. I'm going to pray, and then we'll have a time of communion together, and then we're going to have our meeting, and then the eating together. I'm going to skip out after the sermon, after the prayer, and after communion, and then I will pray for you as I drive home. Our Father, we thank you for Jesus, our King. And I thank you for all the foreshadowing in King David's life and ministry. And we long to be joyful to a new depth because of you, Jesus. And to give full-hearted service as you direct us to each other and to the calling you have for us. And Father, may our fellowship be one of mutual sharing even more deeply than it is. And Father, direct our worship that you be glorified. We pray all together through Jesus, our Lord. Amen.